Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. The great Chinese military philosopher Sun Tzu once said, "If you know the enemy and you know yourself, you need not fear the result of 100 battles." So that's what we're here to talk about today, our top adversary, China. And let's acknowledge the obvious here. China is a huge topic. They often get painted as a 10-foot tall giant, but today we're going to sort out fact from fiction on those assertions. And to do that, let's focus on one aspect of China, the People's Liberation Army Air Force, or the PLA Air Force, or PLAF for short. So with that, we're going to talk to folks from a tremendous research center that is breaking the mold when it comes to China, the Air Force's Air University China Aerospace Studies Institute, or CASI for short. Their staff is made up of some of the best minds and Chinese linguists that the U.S. has to offer, and they bring their expertise into translation and analysis of Chinese military strategy and operations so that our airmen and guardians have a clearer sight picture into the Chinese airmen's mindset. And let's face it, the U.S. Air Force is going to be on the front lines of this fight, so we had better understand the threat. And to help me with this conversation, I'm going to bring in our senior analyst, Daniel Rice. He has lived and studied in China and is fluent in Mandarin, so he'll be able to dive into these issues. So Dan, welcome to the Aerospace Advantage.
谢谢大哥邀请我来参加这个播客。Oh, shoot, sorry, Slick, wrong podcast. Thanks, it's awesome to be here. I'm really excited for today's conversation.
So Dan, what's the China threat elevator pitch as you see it, and how do you scale the scope and challenges facing us?
You know, Slick, if you ask a lot of people in Washington, they'll tell you, you know, China's really complicated, it's really difficult, it's a really big problem. And, you know, they're right, to some extent. The way that I like to see it, and I kind of came up with this metaphor, is that China's like one of the pyramids of Giza, right? It looks like this tremendous behemoth from a ways away. When you get closer, it's really just a bunch of bricks stacked on top of each other. And so the PLAAF, the PLAF, they're one of those bricks that make up that bigger, let's call it, looming and scary picture that is China. So that's kind of like what we're getting into today, is we're going to pick apart the PLAF, one of those bricks, and really see what's underneath and what makes up that aspect of China. And so I have one more thing, just so as a little primer for our audience here. When you look at China, there's two aspects to really getting good analysis. One is language, and another is being a historian, because a lot of these things take a lot of time. So you look at the history of China. So in today's discussion, you might hear quite a bit of that history, but it's all just trying to give you a clearer sight picture on what the PLAF is.
Well, Dan, I really appreciate that. I would say that in my reading and studying and getting to know this adversary, which is China, is you're right. It's approached as this big, giant, scary thing that's really, really hard to understand. So here on the Aerospace Advantage, we're going to dive into the deep end head first. And we're really going to start picking it apart to get beyond that initial part of, hey, this is just really complicated and nobody understands it, to really, and to your point, begin with some of the history. Start to understand the history so that we can evaluate what the current PLAF is today, and then be able to strategize and look into the future. So I really appreciate you grounding us, and of course you've brought some great experts to have this really in-depth conversation today.
Yeah, Slick, you know, the folks that are here today in this conversation are some of the leading experts on the PLAF and China writ large in DC and really in the U.S. One of the things that CASI's really known for is their awesome language analysis, their excellent insight through experience, and also they're helping create that lexicon of language that other Chinese analysts like myself use to describe these issues, right? And it's really important to hear straight from the mouths of the people that are they're writing on this, that are thinking about it every day. And that's why we've got two authors of one of the leading books on the PLAAF here with us today. So I'm super excited for this conversation, and I'm really, really looking forward to hearing what these guys have to say.
Well, Dan, with that, let's hear from CASI Direct. Well, today we have three special guests with us. We have the director of the China Aerospace Studies Institute, Dr. Brendan Mulvaney. And Dr. Mulvaney was a Marine aviator for 2.5 decades and is one of the leading experts in D.C. on China's military, language, and culture.
Hey, Slick, thanks for having me here today.
Sir, great to have you here. And we also have Ken Allen from CASI and Christina Garofalo, who is an associate policy researcher at the RAND Corporation, two of Washington's leading experts on the PLAAF, and co-authors of the book 70 Years of the People's Liberation Army Air Force, which we will dive into in our discussion.
Thanks to both of you for inviting us.
Yeah, thanks for inviting us.
All right, well, Dr. Mulvaney, let's get started with you first. As a director of CASI, can you tell us a little bit about CASI's mission and its value to the United States Air Force?
Sure. The mission of CASI is to advance the understanding of China's aerospace forces, and we take that as a pretty broad term. And then we lump onto that the civilian and commercial infrastructure that supports them, because in China it really is all just one big entity, a whole of government, a whole of society. And so by studying what we like to say is, quote, everything that flies in China, we can better understand the decision-making, the limitations, opportunities, and challenges in the competition with China that we face. So CASI is here to support the Department of Defense, as well as the China research community writ large, by leveraging publicly available, and you know, that's one thing that we do very well, is we use publicly available native language sources, as well as partnerships across the DoD interagency, as well as academia and defense-related think tanks. And we do that to gain insights, to publish some world-class research on Chinese activities, all in this context of great power competition.
So, Dr. Mulvaney, how does the material that you create at CASI really shape the way that the DoD, and maybe more broadly, our allies and partners view China and our Chinese counterparts?
Well, I'm really glad that you phrase it that way. So one of the best parts of my job and the strength of CASI is that almost everything that we do is based on publicly available information. And because of that, I could talk freely to those people across government, but even more importantly than that, to our allies and partners. Too often, we have topics or information that we in the U.S. government think are too sensitive to share. But we at CASI, we're able to share and talk to all of our allies and partners and explain to them what we know about China, what we know about their aerospace forces and their aerospace ecosphere, and really help them strengthen through our interactions to help them strengthen themselves and understand the nature of the competition. We currently have ongoing research partnerships with Australia and Japan and have been invited to England and France and India to talk about these things. So I think CASI's filling a vital niche in this regard.
Well, I know that we also have listeners out in Japan and Australia, so I'm sure they're thrilled to hear from you. So I have to ask this. What are the key trends in the PLAAF, and what are some of the things coming out of CASI that we should be looking for?
Good question. So I think the PLAAF's nascent efforts to become more agile force, as we understand that term, is really one of the big pushes. And this is something that CASI is working on right now. And I think as they try to move up that ladder, this could change how they fight. So it will be pretty key, as well as how the new PLAAF is going to fit into the reorganization that the PLA just went in the 2015-2016 timeframe, with a real move toward jointness. And so that's really one of the big pushes right now, is how is the Air Force going to change, and how is it going to fit into the joint fighting that the PLA wants to be able to do in the future. They certainly can't do it now, but they know where they want to go, and they're trying to get there. The other thing, I think another general trend in the PLA that's specifically taken root in the Air Force, is how much training is being pushed back down to a basic level and relieving operational units of that burden. So we saw this in how the PLA Navy approached training its pilots, and we see it as far as the Air Force has changed its fighter pilot training, pushing it back to a lower level and not making on-the-job training at units that important. So I think we see that probably in the way that they're going to start approaching basic enlisted training as well. As far as what we're working on, we have projects looking at information operations, electronic warfare. The China-Russia partnership is, of course, always a hot topic. Hypersonics, nuclear issues and deterrence, and then again our partnerships with the Australian Strategic Policy Institute in Australia and CASPIS in Japan.
Well, Dr. Mulvaney, I just want to say thanks so much for giving us that breakdown, and I think this is really the first time that we've said things like PLA
Air Force and PLA Army on the podcast, and of course diving into the Navy as well. So going to make the announcement that we are going to be putting a lot more China related podcasts together for our listeners, and we really need to understand the threat. And so you're just scratching the surface. So we really look forward to chatting with you, Dr. Mulvaney, and joining us in a lot of those future discussions.
I absolutely look forward to continuing the conversation, because it is vital as we move forward.
Absolutely. And, you know, this year marked the 100th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party. And as we know, China is rising. So the time of Cassie's new book, The 70 Years of the PLA Air Force, couldn't be any better. So today we have two very special guests that are going to jump in and explore in depth to this recent Cassie publication.
Ken and Christina, everybody here at Mitchell would like to offer you both a big congratulations on the recent publishing of your book, 70 Years of the People's Liberation Army Air Force. It's quite an accomplishment. So big picture first, why did you write the book? What are the key takeaways you want the audience to absorb while reading it?
So I was an assistant air attaché in Beijing from 1987 to 89. And before I went to Beijing, I knew nothing at all about the PLA Air Force's organizational structure at all. The only books that were available was anything about hardware. So when I got there, I had basically no baseline at all to work from. And I was only the third assistant air attaché in 1987 when I got there. So I will never forget, though, I was there roughly about a year, and I happened to have a meeting with a PLA major general. And I still have today, along with my 33-inch binders, the original notes that he wrote out on the organizational structure of the PLA. We're talking the headquarters and department, the administrative component. We did not know that. We didn't even know how many deputy commanders the PLA were or who they were. We had no idea whatsoever. So during my 2 years there, I wrote over 150 pages of material on just the organizational structure of the PLA force. I came back and I taught our military attachés for 3 years, from 1989 to 1992. And during that time, I wrote my first book on the PLA Air Force's organizational structure, a 300-page book. And that laid the foundation. What I cared about was the things that I write about today, is personnel, organizational structure, education, training, big picture training, not down in the weeds type training, and military diplomacy. My biggest takeaways about this whole issue is this. When you look at the PLA Air Force today, everybody goes, well, what are they like today? What are they like today? You cannot just take a snapshot of today unless you understand how they got here, roughly in 10-year increments. And then our last chapter in the book is about predictions for the next 10 years. You look at this and say, okay, where are they going to be in 10 years from now? And that's the key of this. So I think it's really important. And the other thing that I talk about is you should, as a U.S. Air Force person, you should not look at the PLA Air Force through a U.S. Air Force lens. And so usually when I give a briefing to a U.S. Air Force audience, I raise my hand and say, okay, somebody in the audience, tell me how many aircraft are in a U.S. Air Force squadron. And I usually get the range from 15 to 24 airframes. I say, okay, how many aircraft in a PLA Air Force squadron? Oh, it's the same. I say, no, it's not. A PLA Air Force squadron only has 4 to 5 airframes. So right off the bat, if I'm talking to this audience about a PLA Air Force squadron, you're thinking 15 to 24 aircraft. So right off the bat, we're not even talking in the same theme on this. And I think that is really important.
Sure. And on my part, my motivations, I wanted to, and I got interested in the question of where the PLAF was going and where it had been. So, you know, why did some of its capabilities seem to be behind those of the other PLA services? And, you know, what shaped the PLAF's development over time? And, you know, from my perspective, it's important to understand those types of, you know, PLA operations activities that readers in the U.S. Air Force or other parts of the armed forces might encounter or, you know, might otherwise care about. And the interesting thing is that the PLAF might, you know, from some perspectives is a relative newcomer to having this important key role in PLA operations, as Dr. Mulvaney was talking about. When we think about, you know, PLA Navy operations overseas the dominance of the PLA ground forces, this is a pretty recent development for the PLAF. So that was why I wanted to delve into this topic further and collaborate with Ken.
So Ken and Christina, I have a question for both of you. China looks at the issues, at various issues, in a very different way than we do. And what I mean is, you know, from the U.S. perspective, we tend to look back, you know, 50, maybe 100 years or so into history, and that really informs the way that we approach issues today. But from the Chinese perspective, that timeline that they look at might stretch back several hundred years or maybe even several thousand years when they're talking about culture. How does this factor into the way that you look at the PLAF and how the PLAF itself views its role today?
So yeah, we definitely see PLA sources referencing these sort of ancient and glorious historical legacies of the ground and naval forces. Of course, that's not possible for aerospace forces, particularly when you think of heavier than air fixed wing aircraft. And, you know, that's true in China and elsewhere. But as we overview in the book, we certainly find that the historical role of the PLA Air Force shapes its current missions, roles, and its operations. So overall, our main finding in the book from a broad strategy perspective is that the PLAF's development and operations have often been constrained, and that's by domestic political as well as geopolitical, operational, and other factors. So if we, you know, compare to Western air doctrine, which has emphasized Air Force's speed, independence, and decisive capability during conflict, that's basically not been true for most of the PLAF's existence. So as you know, some of your listeners are certainly aware, the PLA has historically been very ground-centric. When it was first founded, and even before its official founding in 1949, developing the Air Force's capability, quote, on the foundation of the ground forces was the guiding principle. And in fact, until the 1993 revision of key PLA guidance, you know, this is 40 or 50 years later, and this guidance is called the Military Strategic Guidelines. The ground forces were predominant all up until the 90s in military strategic thinking. So your naval, air, and missile forces were relegated to supporting roles. What we find and discuss in the book is that PLAF leaders and strategists began to advocate for a more independent and active PLAF role in the 1980s, but they didn't get senior leadership buy-in until the late 1990s and early 2000s. So the key date is in 2004 when China's military high command, the Central Military Commission, endorsed the Air Force's first service-specific strategic concept. And this is now known as, quote, Strategic Air Force. That's the concept name. So this concept has a slogan, and it's the PLA authors regularly cite, and it's, quote, integrated air and space capabilities and coordinated offensive and defensive operations. So that's kind of the two main concepts that we'll talk about a little later on. If we think about the PLAF as a roughly 70-year-old organization and culture, it's basically only in the past 15 years that it's been adopting a similar strategic approach to other capable and sophisticated air forces. And when it comes to air operations over that span of time, which we also review in the book, the PLA Air Force, especially aviation branch, has very little combat experience, essentially none since 1958.
Christina makes a really good point in this. It's about reliability of the PLA Air Force. The points that we have in the book is this. The first pilot to be the commander of the PLA Air Force was 1971. The next pilot to be a commander was Wong Hai in 1985. Even after Wong Hai, the next commander was a political commissar for 5 years who became the commander. He was not a pilot. And so in 1979, Deng Xiaoping, right after the conflict with Vietnam, which the PLA Air Force members flew a single sortie into Vietnam, by the way, Deng Xiaoping said the PLA Air Force needs to modernize, but it bears close scrutiny. And so it always had this overlay of it, of this political commissar system over the top of the PLA Air Force. And basically until 2004, and I know this from interviews with PLA Air Force officers too, that in 2004, they started to believe that the PLA Air Force actually had or responsibility. And as Christina mentioned, it wasn't until 2004 the PLA Air Force had its own strategy, first ever strategy.
Just real quick, I wanted to follow up with that, and those are great points, and how the PLAF views its role. It's still struggling, as Christina kind of outlined, right, because of this, this historical issue about how they've seen themselves. And the problem that they face today, there's plenty of service rivalry within the PLA, right? It's not a homogenous force, and we know that just about the DOD. But the PLA is really, the PLA Air Force is really struggling. They made a bid for greater overwater missions. They used to not fly at all. In fact, we have a handbook that says essentially it's difficult, it's scary, don't do it, leave it to those Navy guys. And so there's some service rivalry there. They've made a bid to take over the bomber mission. So the Navy has long-range bombers that are for the Navy. And the Air Force says, well, if you have an Air Force carrier, an aircraft carrier, why do you need to have bombers? The Navy continues to push back and continues to maintain that. the Air Force also in the Kongtian ET, right? So that's the unified strategy, made a bid to take over the space role. And they lost it, just like our Air Force, lost their bid to maintain the space role. So they're continuing to struggle and find where exactly they fit into global China. And I tell people it's much easier for the Navy to go out because you have international waters. You can bebop around on a ship. The Air Force still needs to land their aircraft somewhere. And until you get a willing country to host an Air Force squadron, it's going to be hard for them to really make a dent in the PLA as a whole.
Yeah, it's really a tremendous wrap up of just the overall structure that I know so many of us don't know a whole lot about. Now, one thing that airmen can relate to is understanding their core missions. But Christina, I've got to ask you, what are the PLAF's core missions and how do they shape the way that the Chinese airmen view and train for conflict?
Sure. So in the 1980s and 1990s, Chinese Communist Party and PLA leaders grew to recognize the importance of air power for modern warfighting. So the need for China's air forces to operate offensively, independently, and beyond China's borders necessitated an evolution of PLAF strategy and role within the PLA. So that's why that strategic air force concept, that's the Chinese for it, was approved in 2004 is so significant. It's the guiding concept that expands the PLA Air Force's role beyond this historical territorial air defense mission into a service that can make important contributions to both offensive and defensive joint operations, as Dr. Mulvaney mentioned earlier. So there's two parts to this concept. First is both offensive and defensive capabilities, right? So the PLAF should be able to conduct independent or coordinated strikes with other services, including long-range precision strikes. At the same time, it has to maintain that historic role, defending China from long-range threats and leveraging both its aircraft and ground-based air defenses. And then the second part is about air and space integration. And interestingly, as Dr. Mulvaney mentioned, the PLAF failed to gain authority over space. That went to, a new organization that was stood up, the Strategic Support Force. But the PLAF's use of space-based systems and assets does continue to grow. And this, makes sense given the PLA-wide focus on leveraging information to both fight and deny information to adversaries. To sum up all of that, a strategic air force, this concept implies and guides the PLAF. It's not only supposed to be able capable of defending Chinese airspace, it's supposed to be able to take the fight to China's opponents. And as we mentioned, the PLAF didn't win that space portfolio, but increasingly leverages space-based assets and information along with the broader joint force in the PLA.
Well, Christina, quickly taking a page from Ken's notes earlier, how can we compare and contrast these missions with the United States Air Force's missions? And, are there common terms that actually mean very different things between the two services when we try to do that comparison? Can you mind to talk to that?
Sure. And admittedly, I'm not an expert on the U.S. Air Force. I very much welcome, your all views on this as well. So one framing to think about, the U.S. Air Force's evolving roles and priorities is from, for example, the fiscal year 21 Congressional Posture Statement. This is from last March. So that statement focused on four, focus areas for the U.S. Air Force going forward. First was connecting and integrating with the Joint Force. Second was leading in space alongside the Space Force. Third was generating combat power. And fourth was conducting logistics under attack. Unfortunately, we don't have a similar document available for the Chinese Air Force, but an authoritative PLA strategy text calls for the PLA Air Force to build, quote unquote, five forces. And these definitely have applications for PLA joint operations. So the five forces are focused on offensive forces, air defense forces, reconnaissance, early warning and surveillance forces, information operations forces, and then strategic transport forces. But thinking about our U.S. Air Force's emphasis on logistics under attack, obviously that's an overseas and global context. And China doesn't have continuous overseas presence for its Air Force to date, right? But as Dr. Mulvaney was saying, we shouldn't be surprised if the PLA pursues overseas locations where the PLAF could operate in the future, right? So this could be either as part of a formal basing presence in the vein of the PLA's first overseas base in Djibouti, where PLA Navy forces are currently stationed. The U.S. Department of Defense in its annual report to Congress last year indicated a number of overseas locations where China may seek to establish military facilities or other access points. So, you know, this area in particular is an area of huge potential growth for the Chinese Air Force. And it's also a huge gap between the U.S. Air Force and PLA Air Force. You know, we've all been reading and watching recent news about the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, and I'm sure there's PLA officers and analysts taking a lot of lessons learned from our airlift operations, for example. I was reading U.S. reportedly airlifted over 120,000 people in 2 weeks. You know, until recent years and deliveries of their new transport aircraft, China's Air Force had less than 24 large transport aircraft. So there's no way that they could, you know, undertake that type of operation overseas, either in terms of scale or just, you know, such a rapid op tempo in a short duration.
Yeah, Christine, I think you hit that nail right on the head with the difference between, you know, more regional and more global operations. That's absolutely spot on. I would like to transition a little bit here away from the operational and go towards more of the structural differences, right? So you mentioned earlier the Central Military Commission and its role in the PLA. Can you talk to us so our audience gets a little bit better understanding of exactly what is the Central Military Commission? What about it has changed? And how does that affect the People's Liberation Army Air Force?
Sure thing. So when we talk about the Central Military Commission, or I'll use the acronym CMC, as I talk in the book, what we find is that Chinese senior leaders and senior PLA leaders trust in the PLAF has evolved a lot over time. And also these leaders realize they need a more capable Air Force to support joint operations in the future. And this has impacted and changed the PLAF's relationship with the CMC, which is China's overall military high command. So at the same time, the senior leaders were endorsing the strategic Air Force concept in 2004. We saw the PLAF commander, the Navy commander, and then the Missile Forces commander join the CMC as members for the first time by dint of leading those services. And this is likely to promote jointness within the force and focus on joint operations. Another element of this change is if you are focused on joint operations at a organizational command level, theoretically, your composition of senior leaders will become more joint over time, right? So non-army leaders will rise up the ranks of the PLA overall. And you see at least some emphasis in promoting or at least having a few joint leaders or non-army leaders on the CMC right now. So one of the two vice chairmen, Xu Qiliang, is from the PLA Air Force. So I think that's something to watch for the future is does this military high command, its leadership, you know, continue to become more joint? And what do senior leaders look like at the PLA going forward?
I've spent a lot of time looking at organizational structure. And during the 1970s, there were 65 CMC members. Not a single one was Air Force. Really key issue. And so today, prior to 2016, the Central Military Commission was basically composed of what was called the four general departments: General Staff, Political, Logistics, and Equipment Department. But in reality, that was the Army headquarters first and the Joint Headquarters second. In 2016, when they went to a theater command structure, they went to 15 CMC organizations. But even today, not a single director or deputy director is a non-Army officer. No Air Force, no Navy, no what's called Rocket Force now. But the five theater commands, which used to be seven military reasons, in my view, are truly joint organizations today. There are, of the five theater commands, one of them, the Central Theater Command, the commander is Air Force General, three-star. There's no four-star generals in the PLA, a three-star general. His name is Yi Xiao Guang, and he is an Air Force General. Under him, there is an Army, one permanent Army, one permanent Navy, one permanent Air Force Deputy Commander. Then under each of the theater commands, there's a Theater Command Air Force, and there's a commander. And I always point this out, you never want to say the deputy commander, because every organization from the Central Military Commission down to the platoon level has at least two deputy commanders. So you never say the deputy commander. Each of them has different responsibilities. Really key. So the five theater commands are truly joint organizations today.
Well, Ken, one of the things you mentioned in your book, and really what you're known for, is eloquently explaining how the ranks and grades are different in the PLAF compared to other air forces across the globe. So can you explain what the main difference is here and how does that operation affect the PLAF?
I think the most important thing is this. In our Air Force, you have O1 to O10, from a second lieutenant to a four-star general. And so, but each of those are assigned to personnel. Think of the headquarters Air Force as being an O-10 organization. Think of PACAF as being an O-9 organization. It doesn't work that way for us. So it wasn't until 2000 that I found out that there's this thing called a grade system. Besides the 10 ranks, there are 15 grades. But grades are assigned to organizations as well as personnel. And the grade structure is what defines command and control. You can command an organization below you. You can only coordinate with an organization at the same level. So again, think of us here as having a 4-star as the chief of staff of the Air Force, a 4-star as PACAF commander. In the PLA Air Force, the commander of the PLA Air Force is a 3-star. The commander of PACAF counterpart, basically, the 5 Theater Commander Air Force is only a 2-star. But one of the issues is here, because there's 15 grades and 10 ranks, grades and ranks are never, you do not receive a grade and a rank promotion at the same time. So when you say, oh, he got promoted, you have to clarify, he got a grade promotion or a rank promotion. Every grade up to the regiment level has 2 ranks, but some grades or some ranks, such as Major General, can be 4 different grades. So if I walk into a room and I'm all PLA personnel, I call the person by their last name and their position, deputy commander, deputy leader, whatever, which is equivalent to their grade. Since an American walks, oh, this is Colonel so-and-so, this is Lieutenant Colonel so-and-so, because they're talking to us through our lens. But what was really nice is in 2007, suddenly, the PLA, all of their uniforms, their dress uniforms, they begin to wear ribbons. And their ribbons have X number of rows and 1 or 2 stars at the top in the center row. And then you count the lines in there and it tells you how many years they are and what their grade is. No awards whatsoever on those ribbons. So now I walk into a room and I look at somebody and say, oh, I see your senior school. But I look at their ribbons and I say, oh, I see your deputy division leader, grade officer. Oh my gosh, let me tell you more. And that opens up that door for that conversation and it defines how they communicate and talk to each other. That's a real key issue.
Yeah, so that's a great important distinction between how the United States is organized and how the PLA is organized. And we need to keep that in mind whenever we talk about that. So one of the other key differences between the PLA Air Force and the U.S. Air Force is the PLA Air Force does not control any of the rockets or missiles, right? That's in their rocket force. So they don't have control of conventional or nuclear weapons. Those are in the rocket force at this point. And now there's a talk in the PLA of going to use a triad, and maybe the Air Force will get some air-deliverable nuclear weapons, but that's still to be seen. The other thing is, of course, the PLA Strategic Support Force that we talked about took on the space and the cyber mission, which, of course, the Air Force has a large cyber mission. So those are some key differences between the two Air Forces. As far as how the grades fit in, Ken hit the nail on the head. The grade is the bureaucratic importance, right? So at this point, the rank is just kind of a way to give different compensation and to make people, especially foreign officers, understand their counterparts. But it's really the grade that determines how important you are. And you can't command somebody, like Ken said, at the same grade. What you need is a common higher commander. So this is one of the reasons that the PLA Air Force tried to switch to brigades, was to solve this intra-service problem, right? They had a very hard time getting dissimilar aircraft because they were in different units. They needed a common headquarters. Looking at this more broadly, what are the implications of that when the PLA tries to go joint? Because it needs this common headquarters, it's really difficult. The U.S., we deal with this all the time, right? I'm a Marine. I get on a boat, the Navy captain's in charge, the Marine colonel looks at the Navy captain and says, what do you need? Hey, we need time to break glass, the Marines got to go ashore, the Navy captain turns to the Marine colonel and says, what do you need to support it? Right? The Marines go ahead, we drop warheads on foreheads, we kill everybody we need to on the ground, we get back on the Navy ship, the Marine colonel turns back to the Navy captain and says, hey, we're back on the boat, you're in command. This cannot happen in today's PLA for organizational structures alone. So what are the implications of that going forward? That's one of the things we like to keep an eye on at CASI as we try to understand the differences in the just the organizational structures.
Let me just throw one more thing in here. Dr. Mulvaney mentioned the brigade structure. The PLA Air Force in the 1980s had 50 air divisions. Every air division had 3 regiments. You come in as a brand new officer. You work your way up through this grade system. you become a deputy platoon commander, deputy company commander, yada, yada, yada. You work your way up there. The problem now, though, is that going to a brigade structure, it is causing problems for career paths because you used to be able to be a battalion commander, deputy regiment commander, deputy division commander. Now, there's no regiments. So you go from a battalion to a division level, and for 3 years, you lose any command. So this is one of the issues, a personnel issue that the PLA is having to deal with. People are having a difficult time moving up their career paths because of going to the brigade structure. And it's all about grades.
And that is absolutely fascinating. You know, we have our own organizational problems, but clearly China has much, much more of them. This next question's for everybody here. So I know from my experience reading Chinese that there's often a lot of different words or phrases that get used in different ways than we would in English. And that subtle context and the nuance in the language really shapes the way that we view different issues. So I've got to ask, are there any different trends or different words that we've got to be looking out for that might not mean the same thing in English and that people who don't necessarily read Chinese should be watching?
I mentioned earlier the use of the word squadron. When you look at the PLA Air Force, you need to look at the way PLA Air Force lens, not a USAF lens. Very key issues. And I've got like four different terms I will just roughly say here. Number one, the word airman has come up. The PLA Air Force does not have a word for airman. Officers are officers in cadre. Enlisted personnel are soldiers. So if you're talking about PLA Air Force airmen, we're not talking to them, we're talking past them. The second thing that I would point out, we use the word professional military education. The PLA does not have a word for professional military education. It has what's called cultivation and training. When you go to our Air War College, you go to the Air Command and Staff, you can, as a major, you can get a master's degree. As a lieutenant colonel, you can go to the Air War College and get a master's degree. If you go to their Air Force Command College, you get a certificate. So it's a completely different situation. And then the other thing is, I always point this out, I hear this all the time, people talk about PLA Air Force air supremacy and air superiority. They do not have those terms. They use the term command of the air, which means control of a given airspace over a given period of time, which is roughly equivalent to our air dominance. And the final thing that I would say, well, next to the final thing I would say, is I hear U.S. Air Force, they're offensive counter air and defensive counter air. The PLA Air Force does not use those terms. They use the terms air offense campaign and air defense campaign. And the last thing, I see people talking about the PLA Air Force's KJX AWACS. The PLA Air Force does not use the word AWACS. They use the word airborne early warning and command, AEWNC, which are completely different than our AWACS. So, they have AWACS just like us, so they must be the same. They're not the same. So when you really have to dig down in what is the term and what does it mean, not just the terms.
Yeah, I agree with Ken's broader point. We can't mirror image everything or certain ways that we think about the Chinese military in comparison to our military. We definitely see the PLA and the Chinese Air Force studying the U.S. way of war a lot, right? But how China chooses to adapt our concepts and terms and its activities for its own needs is pretty complex. So sometimes, there's mental shortcuts we can take as U.S. warfighters or analysts or policymakers in using a term that we employ in our own military, but that might embed a lot of assumptions about how the PLA is thinking or operating. So I see kind of three challenges or examples, from reading Chinese language documents. First, sometimes there's a gap between aspiration and reality. So the documents will talk about, we plan to do this, our objective is this. In reading many of them over time or getting, different takes on the same topic, you'll see where they actually did achieve something and where they're still talking about gaps, right? Second, sometimes there's sensitive discussion points and, they'll get talked kind of around or in an indirect manner, but they might not be highlighted in documents that make it into English. And then third, sometimes there's rhetorical shots. These are lobbed for external consumption, think about wolf warrior diplomacy. But doubts might be buried in some analyst paper in Chinese, right? And that's, not the thing that gets translated first per se. So having those language skills or You know, leveraging research that builds on them helps you dig into those areas. And then relatedly, there's a fire hose problem, right? So there's tons of, you know, PLA analyses, documents, reporting. It's never translated. And, you know, we need to sift through it and select, right? What's of high interest and value. So I think that's actually kind of part of the future of PLA research is how can linguists leverage computer-based tools? How can we get those interesting insights, you know, to the warfighter or, you know, to the broader community?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, different concepts lead to different tactics, techniques, and procedures and ways of thinking about things that we just wouldn't understand or don't understand why the PLA does something that they do because they just look at the world differently. So that's really important for us to be able to look at that and parse it. The other thing I would say is something that Cassie has started is just to try to solve this problem. We have this new series called In Their Own Words, which translates Chinese documents, source documents, that makes it available to people without Chinese. We have some good partners, CMSI is helping us. The folks at Project Everest have been key for this. But the idea is that if you don't speak Chinese, you have to rely on somebody else who's reading it, right? And so you're probably doing second, third, fourth hand analysis and not understanding what they're talking about. So by able to translate these things and make it available to a wider audience, hopefully we get better processes and better understanding of what they're doing. So we have better responses from the United States Air Force. And the thing I tell people is, you know, the Chinese are good communists. What I mean by that is they like to plan. And then they'll publish the plan. They'll talk about how the plan is going, how it's tracking, and what their adjustments are. And all we need to do is be able to look at their documents. And they will largely tell us the broad outlines of what they're planning to do now and in the future.
Ken, I've got to ask you, from the most junior enlisted person in our United States Air Force up to our top generals, what should every airman know about China and more specifically the PLAF?
I recently reached out to some USAF friends and asked them, what keeps a USAF unit commander awake at night? And I got the basic answer: morale, health, families, ethnic and gender, professional issues, maintenance, yada, 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 all of these things. But when I read the Air Force daily news, all I read about the PLA Air Force is how they're moving up this ladder and moving up this ladder with their technology and all that. If we're going to look at the PLA Air Force and compare it to the U.S. Force, you have to look at them across the board. Not just at doctrine, not just at the hardware. You need to look at the personnel component, organizational component, every single piece of that. You have to look one by one by one and see how they are and how we are. That's how you get to a final view of where we are in comparison with the PLA Air Force.
Thank you for that, Ken. So, Dr. Mulvaney and Christina, China has set 2049 as the year to become a world-class military. So first off, how might you define that, the world-class aspect? And second, what are the top items we should be tracking as they make this journey?
That's a fantastic question. And I'll say it's an open question at this point. CMSI had the same questions about the PLA Navy and had a whole conference on it. And I suspect if you asked 20 different people this question, you'd get probably 30 different answers. So what we understand them to mean is to be basically able to do everything that the U.S. Air Force does, which is why they've set 2049. One, it's the 100th anniversary of the PRC, but it's also a stretch goal for them. What they're aiming for in the midterm is to basically be able to do what I like to call good enough. Right. So we need to keep in mind that not everything that China does is to do with the United States. Right. We like to look at Washington, Beijing as the two poles of the world and everything revolves around that. China lives in a dangerous neighborhood. They have a lot of disputes with their neighbors. They've got India. They've got the DPRK. They have, you know, a now growing relationship with Russia, but it hasn't always been that way. They have territorial disputes in the South China Sea. They have a dispute with Japan. So they live in a dangerous neighborhood. And they have those people that they're concerned about. And so not everything that they're looking for has to go toe-to-toe with the United States. Some of it is against these other challengers, some of whom are treaty allies, Japan, Philippines, and Thailand. And so they're looking to be good enough. And the other part of being good enough is to make sure that U.S. planners take pause. And so they don't have to go toe-to-toe. You know, a J-20 and F-35 don't have to go toe-to-toe if they can keep the F-35 away because they've scared us too far, right? You know, if they've deterred us properly, and they've kept, you know, U.S. Air Force carriers at bay because of ballistic missiles and things like that. And so I think that as a world-class Air Force, what they're looking to be able to do is conduct worldwide operations. They talk about their growing interests around the world. We see the first base, like Christina alluded to. There's going to be more. They want to be able to deploy. They want to be able to fight. They want to be able to win, and they actually now talk about winning, which is something new for them. They have a long way to go. But again, as Ken likes to say, they've built that ladder, and they're starting to climb. The thing that I would say is they are closing that gap. They tend to close that gap a little bit more quickly than we thought they were going to be able to, but we're still climbing that ladder as well. So we are not in decline. They're closing the difference, but as they get closer and closer to us, it's becoming more and more difficult for them to close that final gap. The final thing to keep in mind is that they're basically playing a home game, and we're going to have to go and fight. And the way that we're going to be able to do that is partners and allies and friends and all those people that I talked about, that China is looking at. And we can have a good discussion about standoff forces or stand-in forces. But Japan and the Philippines and Vietnam and Indonesia and even the Koreans, they are stand-in, live-in forces. And we need to take that into account because they really are our strength when it comes to this challenge.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And when we see, world-class military, this is a call for improving capability across the PLA. And then when we see PLA Air Force leaders talking about it's in terms of how do they build a quote-unquote world-class Air Force, which, as Dr. Mulvaney said, they haven't specified exactly either. But at least, some PLA Air Force leaders have talked about what do those milestones mean? What do we do by 2020 to get to a quote-unquote world-class Air Force in 2049? And one thing that's striking to me is, at least one of these statements, a PLAF leader said, we're going to build by 2020 a strategic force that integrates aviation and space power and strike and defense capabilities. Now, that might sound a little familiar, and that's because it's pretty much the exact language from the Strategic Air Force concept with which they've been talking about since 2004. And there's no indication that the PLAF has said, hey, we've made significant progress on this. We're ready to, continue, to build from there. Every white defense white paper China's published, they've said they've been working on this goal for the PLA Air Force. So I think that's, again, gets to that, gap or potential gap between aspiration and reality. I think they realize they have a lot more work to do on integration with the joint force and being able to carry out those offensive operations. That leads to a second caveat is there's no real recent combat experience among PLAF aviators, right? So how the PLAF might be called on to operate in the Western Pacific in a future conflict, the stresses and strains that apply on air crews, maintenance, and logistics, all that's really important. And, our book hits some of those highlights on what's likely to continue to impact PLAF operations going forward.
That's a great point Christina makes. And I just wanted to tag in real quick. You ask about what we should be looking at. And I think something that gets undervalued in our estimation is the changes in training and exercise that the PLA Air Force has undergone. They didn't used to do hardly any real world combat training because they're not in combat. They have no other option but to do this. And over the last 10 or 15 years, they have made huge strides. It used to be all rote and scripted, and now they're getting very close to what we would call free air combat and what they call back-to-back operations. So I think that's something we need to pay a lot more attention to, and I'm glad that Ken and Christina talk about it in the book.
Well, I just want to say a huge thank you to all three of you for being here today. It's clear that this is a really important topic, and to hear your insights, just incredibly thought-provoking.
Well, thanks to both of you for inviting us today. And thanks again to Dr. Mulvaney and Christina for everything they did to get the book through and to come in today. And it wouldn't be what it is without them.
Yeah, thanks again for having us. And I look forward to the future conversations because, as we know, this is a long-term, broad-ranging competition that we're going to be dealing with for a long time. So thanks a lot.
Yeah, we really appreciate you hosting us. We hope the book is interesting and useful to people. And hope it starts a conversation for warfighters and different organizations across the U.S. Air Force.
Well, Dan, thanks so much for helping me co-host this episode today. China is such a huge topic, and there are many more vectors that we are going to explore.
谢谢大家来听我们的播客，祝你们周末愉快。 Thanks, everybody, for listening. I know this is a really complex topic, and I'm really excited to dive deeper into it. So thanks again, and everybody have a great weekend.
With that, I'd like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning into today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to The Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter,
Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn. And you can always find us at MitchellAerospacePower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.